Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on diagnosing and treating epithelioid sarcoma. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online activity, Drs. Marka Golnick, Xander D'Angelo, Mernal Gounder, and Sujana Mova will discuss how to diagnose epithelioid sarcoma early and utilize multidisciplinary care to optimize treatment for this difficult disease. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Ipsen. In the first segment, Dr. Golnick discusses the epidemiology of epithelioid sarcoma.
So what we know, if we look at soft tissue sarcoma statistics in both adults and children, there has been an uptake since 1996 to 2020 of new cases diagnosed per year. And currently, we're thinking about over 13,000 new cases per year with just over 5,000 deaths. It does make up about 1% of all solid malignant cancers. But if we think about epithelioid sarcoma only, this is a very rare sarcoma subtype, and it makes up less than 1% of the sarcomas that we see. And we think there's about 150 to 300 patients diagnosed per year. From an age and primary site of distribution for epithelioid sarcomas, we see that the average patient is going to be in their 30s. We do see patients younger than 20 years of age, but we can also see patients diagnosed into their 70s and beyond. From a distribution standpoint, the majority of epithelioid sarcomas occur in the extremities, either the upper or lower extremity, and that makes up over 50% of the cases that we see.
In the next segment, Drs. Golnick, Mova, D'Angelo, and Gounder discuss some barriers to making the diagnosis of epithelioid sarcoma and some key biopsy considerations.
So we just had an opportunity to review a patient who presents with a 5-centimeter mass, and we see that the patient has an INI1 loss. I guess the first question, this is really geared towards our surgical specialists who work in conjunction with our pathologists, but I'll ask you, Dr. Mova, when you see these patients, how often are you seeing the INI1 loss by itself, and how often are you actually seeing that they also send it for NGS testing and you'll see a SMARCB1 deletion?
Yeah, I think it varies depending on the institution where the patient is diagnosed. I think sometimes one of the barriers can start even at the patient level itself. Someone has this slowly growing mass. You may not think that it's something significant, right? You might think it's something like a cyst, or, you know, often I've heard patients say, I thought it was a ganglion cyst, or I thought it was like a nodule related to like a rheumatoid nodule. When patients have this mass and a biopsy is done, I've had oncologists call us from outside our institution. I think we're very lucky to work in an institution where they may recognize this entity more commonly, but I've had outside oncologists who will call and say, I have this patient and something doesn't fit right. There's a mass in the extremity, but they're calling it a poorly differentiated tumor. And I think it's a sarcoma. So we're sending the patient your way.
I think that oftentimes patients may not realize that a slowly growing mass can be indicative of malignancy. Once that realization has been made, there then can be delays in the system that allows the diagnosis to be made, appropriate imaging, and ultimately really the correct diagnosis, which is very difficult and challenging in the context of sarcomas. The obvious and most important finding is that patients with sarcomas are often not appropriately diagnosed due to the rarity and the number of histological subtypes. Sarcoma is not one disease, but there are 70 to 80 different subtypes of sarcoma. So making the right diagnosis, both based on morphology and looking at the tumor under the microscope, and then really ordering the correct staining and testing and molecular studies can often lead to delays and challenges.
I think when I speak to my colleagues often, and if you think about the surgeons are the ones that are usually the entry point for these patients, If you would ask them what clinical red flags should prompt early biopsy, certainly they would say painful lesions, growing lesions. Often they tell me more than about 5 centimeters, maybe even sometimes more than 3 centimeters. Everything can be a hepatoma, but also everything can't be a malignancy. And so you have to sort of figure out between the two what merits a biopsy. Biopsies obviously come with a lot of anxiety. And then you have to figure out what merits watch and wait. Maybe I'll ask Dr. Gunder if you could answer a little bit about any limitations you see with respect to different biopsies that we use. Do you sometimes see that there's not enough samples and you have to do it more than once? Where do you find, are you, every time someone comes to see you at an academic medical center, are you re-biopsing it? Or would you say that the original biopsy with an NGS that shows a SMARCB1? Is that enough for your diagnosis? The INI1 loss, is that enough for your diagnosis? Or do you rerun the testing to make sure that it is correct?
No, thanks, Mark. That's a very good question. I think it depends, right? Not all INI deleted tumors are epithelioid sarcomas. So I think in the right context, in the right age, in the right presentation, if all that fits, then you can say, okay, this smells like an epithelioid sarcoma. It looks like it, and the whether it's the FISH or the IHC or the SMARCB1, then we don't necessarily repeat it. For the most part, if all of that fits, I don't tell patients to repeat it, as long as, but in some unusual cases, if the presentation is unusual, there can be other tumors like epithelioid angiosarcoma, for example, and other things that can mimic these, even though they have the underlying SMARCB1, INI1 loss. I think in those situations, there may be a role to rebiopsy, but not so much for molecular, but more for just a basic diagnosis done at a tertiary care cancer center.
In the next segment, Dr. D'Angelo discusses the data behind some systemic treatments for epithelioid sarcoma.
When we think about chemotherapy for patients with soft tissue sarcomas, we have a number of goals. First is to treat the metastatic disease. Second, to eradicate microscopic tumor cells. Third, to decrease local recurrence rates. Fourth, to potentially downstage unresectable tumors to enable resection. And importantly, we always aim to understand individual patient tumor biology. And here we just have a table that highlights the response rates either with anthracycline-based therapies, which is first listed, response rates about 22%, median progression-free survival 6 months, median overall survival 16 months, and then with gemcitabine-based therapy, the overall response rate is 27%, the progression-free survival is 4 months, and the median overall survival is 19 months. There's also been efforts looking at the efficacy of pazopanib, and we don't see much in the ways of tumor shrinkage with pazopanib, and the progression-free survival is 3 months, and the median overall survival is 14 months. So as we can see by the available data, there are obvious limitations of chemotherapy for patients with advanced sarcomas, including epithelioid sarcomas. The response rates generally are in the less than 20% range, regardless of the line of therapy, with some exceptions. The duration is quite low. And while I didn't get into it in full detail, there's obvious toxicity associated with chemotherapy, namely neutropenic fever, the potential of cardiotoxicity with anthracyclines, nausea, vomiting, alopecia, all of which can impact quality of life for our patients. Based on the need for new and more promising and alternative treatment options, there was some interest in evaluating EZH2 as a target in epithelioid sarcoma. There's good biologic rationale for this effort. We know that more than 90% of cases of epithelioid sarcomas have loss of INI1 and SMARCB1. INI1 opposes the activity of EZH2 through the SWI-SNF complex, thereby suppressing tumor growth. And further, there's some preclinical evidence suggesting that EZH2 inhibition is synthetically lethal in the setting of this INI1 mutation. There's been interest in exploring EZH2 inhibition in epithelial sarcoma. This is based on robust biological rationale. We know that this particular pathway can lead to aberrant signaling of the Wnt pathway, of sonic hedgehog pathways, of the polycomb pathway, and ultimately really impact the cell cycle. And so inhibiting EZH2 is a rational pathway to evaluate. So in this phase study of tazemetostat in patients with advanced INI1 negative epithelial sarcoma, a total of 62 patients were enrolled. The median age was 34. Approximately 63% of patients were male and 37% were female. Most of the patients had either proximal or distal subtype, as is indicated in the slide. And the median lines of prior anti-cancer therapy was one, although 61% of patients had received more than one line of therapy. When we look at the efficacy, the overall response rate was 15%. While there were no complete responses, 15% of patients had partial responses, 56% of patients had stable disease, and 21% of patients had progressive disease. The median duration of response was not reached. The disease control at 32 weeks was 26%. The median progression-free survival is 5.5 months, and the median overall survival is 19 months. Here we have the waterfall plots of tazemetostat in advanced epithelial sarcoma. This was FDA approved in January 2020, and based on this international open label phase two study. As we can see here, the partial response rate was 15%, and the swimmer plot highlights the durability of those that had responses. The median progression-free survival was 5.5 months, and the median overall survival was 19 months. When we look at tolerability, there were a number of adverse events that were mostly grade one or two. The most common adverse events included fatigue, nausea, pain, occurring in approximately 27 to 30% of patients. In addition, some patients had a decreased appetite, vomiting, constipation, all in the 20% range. There were minimal grade three events. Again, these most commonly were fatigue, pain, or decreased appetite. Hematological toxicities occurred in grade three or higher in 13% of patients, most commonly anemia. And further, there were 2% of patients that had lymphopenia. Based on these efficacy data in epithelial sarcoma, tazemetostat is now listed as a preferred regimen in our NCCN soft tissue sarcoma treatment guidelines.
In the next segment, Doctors D'Angelo, Ogolnik, and Gounder discuss their approaches to treating a patient with metastatic epithelioid sarcoma.
Here we have a case of a 32-year-old man. The patient's biopsy confirmed epithelioid sarcoma with INI1 loss. The imaging demonstrated lung metastases. He initiated therapy first with doxorubicin. Imaging demonstrated stable disease after six cycles of treatment. That led to a treatment break. After approximately 9 months, imaging demonstrated growth of lung metastases, which led to the initiation of treatment with gemcitabine and docetaxel. The patient received approximately four cycles of gemcitabine and docetaxel and ultimately had progressive disease. He then went on to start tazemetostat. The patient was on tazemetostat for approximately 6 months. Okay, so in this case, the patient received standard cytotoxic chemotherapy. As a reminder, we know that standard chemotherapy can offer response rates of about 15% with doxorubicin, Alternatively, there's been some reports that have highlighted that gemcitabine and docetaxel can lead to a slightly higher response rate, perhaps in the 20 plus percentage range. Given that this patient has INI1 loss, an alternative approach could have been starting with tazemetostat, which may offer an opportunity to treat the patient with an approach that is perhaps slightly less toxic and often better tolerated than standard chemo. And so I likely would have discussed that approach in this particular patient using tazemetostat and perhaps reserving the cytotoxic chemotherapy for later. In addition, given the slightly improved response rates with gemcitabine docetaxel, I perhaps would have went to gemcitabine and docetaxel as my first cytotoxic chemotherapy approach. I will note and highlight that many of these reports with the standard cytotoxic chemotherapy regimens are retrospective in nature, and there are sort of limitations and caveats of the data. And ultimately, I think it's important to consider the patient, their preferences, and always with the goal of maintaining quality of life and minimizing morbidity and any undue toxicity with our treatment regimens and approaches.
When you're meeting someone for the first time after the diagnosis of metastatic disease, so you may have this longitudinal relationship with them already, what is the discussion like? What are you presenting to them? What are you talking about? What type of endpoints are you looking for? Talk a little bit about what your thought process is and how you relay that to the patient.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think the first thing we have to sort of set the stage here is that, so much of tazemetostat discussion here is really centered on 62 patients in the metastatic or locally advanced setting in a single arm, and that's it. So a lot of these questions about, what do we do, if a disease presents 2 years later or 3 months later, is really unknown. And we are at this time, I would say, just sharing our own anecdotal experiences in these different cases. So if the way I, if a patient initially had a local therapy and then eventually had a metastatic disease, if it is within 3 months, to me, that is not, that is an, not, that is a time to do cytotoxic chemotherapies, because to me, that says that this disease is moving fast, it's growing fast, and it's not a time for localized therapy or radiation or tazemetostat even. That is a place for me for where I would strongly favor cytotoxic chemotherapies, because it tells me that this disease is moving fast. The key thing here is that tazemetostat, which is an epigenetic reprogramming drug, really takes a long time to work. These things, it takes weeks, maybe much longer, months, for things to reprogram and to work. And if a disease is very fast growing, that may not be the best sort of a setting to use that drug. If a disease, say metastatic, even in the lung, were to come back, 2 years into it, then I would strongly favor sort of a tazemetostat priming sort of approach, because I do think that there may be some kind of an immunological programming that may happen here. And especially the patient's not, if the lung volume is low, the patient's asymptomatic, and we have the time to try out this drug, that's something that I certainly try out. But eventually, if it doesn't have a complete response, with the intention to then use other things such as even surgery in a few months, because I want to use that time to see, is this disease really sensitive to tazemetostat or not? But I think for, again, we don't know in epithelioid sarcoma, is it correct to have oligometastatic resections? We don't know that. But if borrowing from other sarcomas, we can say if it's been a long enough duration, that maybe it makes sense. Maybe we can send them for a surgical thoracic resection or ablations, radiation, and such.
Just to pinpoint you to be more specific, and I'm imagining when you're talking about cytotoxic chemotherapy in that 3 month range, you are talking about doxorubicin.
Correct. Yes. I
Yes.
yeah. Yeah. Not just doxorubicin. There's very good data from the German group, from Pink et al., even on the role of gemcitabine docetaxel. Their sample size was low, was like 25, 26 patients, but the response rate they reported at 50% RECIST response rates. So I think we're not wedded to doxorubicin-based therapy. I think any kind of cytotoxic chemotherapy, I think gemcitabine, docetaxel, or dox, they're both all fair game.
In the next segment, Drs. Mova, Agalnik, Gounder, and D'Angelo discuss management strategies for a patient with locally advanced epithelioid sarcoma.
My case is that of a 23-year-old student with a two-month history of left groin and then thigh pain, initially presented with groin pain, and then more of a posterior thigh pain. Ultimately, she presented to her primary care physician, and an MRI was ordered, which showed a 10-centimeter mass in the proximal aspect of the posterior thigh, abutting the proximal hamstring and the adductor magnus muscles. There was marked edema throughout her thigh, and as well as a few satellite subcutaneous nodules. There was right groin and pelvic adenopathy. The patient initially presented to the surgery team for the possibility of resection. A biopsy and imaging was ordered. Further imaging on CT chest was negative for any metastases. The biopsy showed epithelioid sarcoma proximal type. Immunostains showed that the tumor was positive for cytokeratins as well as EMA and negative for TFE3, CD31, ERG-S100, SOX10, CD34, et cetera, and also negative for SMARCB1. Genomic profiling was performed and confirmed by biallelic loss of SMARCB1. And then the patient subsequently had a left groin node biopsy, which confirmed epithelioid sarcoma. The patient was ultimately referred to medical oncology despite coming through the surgery team. There was obviously no, given the lymph nodes and the groin and the pelvis, upfront surgery was not indicated, but there was concern that a palliative procedure because of the symptom burden may be needed in the future. Patient was started after fertility preservation on doxorubicin ifosfamide, and then really had a tough time with that, not just with side effects, including neutropenic fever, but also just clinical progression, including significant swelling and pain related to her disease.
Thank you very much for that case. Very unfortunate situation. Talk to us a little bit about the initial process and the initial thought and why you chose doxorubicin and ifosfamide as opposed to any other drug therapy.
Yeah, I think for sarcoma oncologists, doxorubicin is our first line standard of care for many sarcomas, just because it's reliable and cytotoxic chemotherapy, we believe has a higher rate of response. And someone who is so symptomatic like this, I really wanted a response. And so that's why doublet chemotherapy was chosen. The patient was young and would tolerate doublet chemo. And so obviously, there's no head-to-head study of the various chemo regimens, gemcitabine, docetaxel, and doxorubicin ifosfamide. You could go either way, essentially, but doxorubicin-based regimens tend to be the first-line therapies in soft tissue sarcomas.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I couldn't think of a pathway where you wouldn't have done something like that. A doxorubicin-based therapy, doxorubicin combination with ifosfamide, you really needed to get a response and you needed to improve symptoms. And that was your best pathway for doing it. For a patient like this, are you also sending off NGS from the biopsy specimen to see whether or not anything else is going on?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear what Mernal says as well. I have traditionally done that. I haven't really found much more than the SMARCB1 loss, but you see that we did it as part of our routine care of these young patients.
Yeah, I mean, I would do it as well. Often you don't see multiple pathways that could be causing the same problem, but sometimes you could luck out on something. I know that, Murnal, you would have sent off for NGS as well.
I do, but I have to tell you that in all these years, I've never found anything else that has been actionable. So I think these are beyond the SMARCB1. We see nothing consistent or repetitive. So I've never really been able to utilize anything
Would you at this point, Murnell, send the patient for radiation therapy in order to try to get some control of the disease and some control of the pain?
I'm actually a huge fan of radiation in epithelioid sarcomas. I think these tumors are very sensitive to radiation, particularly, not just radiation. I am also a fan of combining radiation with immunotherapy in these sort of settings. And so I think from a radiation perspective, I think these are, first, I want to say this case, these women or men, young men who show up with these proximal epithelioid sarcoma in the lower extremity that then metastasizes or presents in the perineal area to the lymph node is an extremely challenging disease to manage. These are extremely complicated, and unfortunately, the outcomes are generally very poor. And we really struggled with not just controlling disease, but all the complications that happen in this particular anatomic location, whether it be it surgery or radiation, or the disease itself, right? I mean, this is an area for ripe for infections and so many other things. This is an extremely challenging location, anatomical location, but the disease itself is very aggressive. So I agree that doxorubicin ifosfamide is a very good choice. You could also do gemcitabine docetaxel, or if need be, if you're going to do radiation, it would not be unreasonable to combine it with ifosfamide and etoposide, because this way you're sort of getting the big cytotoxic therapies, but also safely able to combine with radiation. So, yeah.
I think this also highlights when we talk about multidisciplinary care, palliative care needs to be involved as well. And having the pain specialist, sometimes this patient high risk of lymphedema, so the lymphedema clinics, things like that, everyone in the ancillary space that could certainly help make the quality of life for these patients better. And so we've talked a lot about the different specialties. We've talked the need to continue to have the surgeons involved. Sometimes you need to get vascular surgery involved, interventional radiology involved in these cases. But these can be very, very discouraging.
So given these patients' symptoms as well as extent of disease burden, this is a situation where we're really hoping to try and palliate the symptoms, and really approaching this patient's care in an aggressive manner would be appropriate. The patient's young and can likely tolerate aggressive chemotherapy. As alluded to by Dr. Mova, frontline doxorubicin with ifosfamide is a reasonable option. I also like the idea of integrating radiation in this patient's care. Obviously, we wouldn't necessarily use doxorubicin in this scenario, but possibly we can consider ifosfamide with radiation. And then alternatively, given the responses that have been noted in some of the retrospective series, we can also consider gemcitabine and docetaxel. So with this patient, there's a number of different cytotoxic chemotherapy options, all which can then, with the goal of potentially improving symptoms.
In the final segment, Dr. Gounder discusses investigational treatment strategies for epithelioid sarcoma.
So we've had a clinical trial looking at tazemetostat doxorubicin. It appears to be reasonably well tolerated without too much myelosuppression. Tazemetostat by itself is a very well tolerated drug with minimal myelosuppression issues. So I think the combination of the two is reasonable. What we don't know is it truly better or superior than doxorubicin by itself? As I mentioned briefly before, there is a body of literature on the role of tazemetostat or other EZH2 inhibitors in combining it with checkpoint blockade. We do think that this drug can, quote, change a cold tumor to a hot tumor. And personally, I'm not a big fan of that entire philosophy of converting tumors to that are inherently cold to hot. But I think there may be a hint that possibly tazemetostat may be doing that. We published a paper in Clinical Cancer Research showing that a patient with an INI deleted chordoma who was on tazemetostat, we did pre and post tumor biopsies. There was a huge change in the tumor microenvironment, and this patient eventually got a checkpoint blockade and did very well in combination with the radiation. So I think there may be something to it, and it's worth looking at it. I have used this very often, and I have had decent results, not great all the time, but there are mixed results. And again, the Children's Oncology Group is investigating this prospectively. And I'm really excited and curious to see what we can learn from that study. In terms of other sort of phase one or other options, I think the injectable viruses are really up and coming right now, and I think there is a there is this could be something that can be investigated definitely as part of a clinical trial or maybe as an off-label use. In terms of injectable viruses, I think T-VEC that we for which it's approved in melanoma may be a reasonable option in combination with checkpoint blockade. Again, I think we just have to acknowledge to the patient that these are really off-label uses in this disease. But given that how serious this is, that it's a reasonable approach to take.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.